From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, pop songs about tattoos, shopping malls, and prom night. We talk with the co-founders of the band Fountains of Wayne, Chris Collingwood and Adam Schlesinger. Their second CD was recently released. Schlesinger received an Academy Award nomination for writing the title song for Tom Hanks' movie, That Thing You Do. Then we talk with Tom Perrotta. His novel, The Wishbones, is about guys who want to be rock stars but play weddings instead. Perrotta's comic novel, Election, about a high school election, is the basis of the film starring Matthew Broderick and Reese Witherspoon. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. NATO suspended its bombing attacks on Yugoslavia today after the first Yugoslav troops began their withdrawal from Kosovo. The phases of the G8 peace plan for Kosovo came together quickly as the UN Security Council voted to authorize an international security force to deploy in Kosovo immediately. The resolution also calls for UN help in rebuilding the heavily damaged infrastructure of the province and creating a civilian administration to govern it. The Security Council passed the resolution today on a 14-0 vote, with China abstaining. NATO said Allied peacekeeping troops could enter Kosovo by tomorrow to ensure the safe return of more than 800,000 ethnic Albanian refugees. Excitement has taken hold of the Albanian town of Kukës near the Kosovo border. 100,000 refugees are there waiting to go home, but doubts persist about when and how they will do so. NPR's Sarah Chase reports from Kukës.
There's a brighter edge to the babble of sound that floats upward from this crowded town each evening. The notion of return is suddenly concrete. Kosovo refugees are beginning to count in days, not months. God bless NATO, said one old man wearing a beret and gently swinging his walking stick to and fro. Still, Kosovars here cling to their doubts, and they wonder about practical matters. How dangerous is it really likely to be to go back to their villages? Are the mines going to be easy to see? Some note the water supply may be poisoned with bodies in wells. They also wonder about what documents they may have to show to cross out of Albania. The UNHCR was supposed to register all Kosovar refugees beginning last month and give them ID cards, but the campaign never got underway. Sarah Chase, NPR News, Kukës, Albania.
The Christian Coalition said today it was reorganizing to resolve a tax dispute with the Internal Revenue Service and to strengthen its political clout. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
The Christian Coalition has been trying to get tax-exempt status for the past 10 years, but critics have complained that the coalition's activities are too political. The IRS reportedly was ready to deny the request. Coalition spokesman Mike Russell would not confirm this, but said the group had decided to withdraw its application for tax exemption.
Christian Coalition needed to resolve this, and it has resolved this issue. It's formed essentially two separate entities that will work. One is a for-profit taxable organization. One is a nonprofit, non-taxable organization, and it will continue the work that it's been doing.
Russell said the for-profit group would make political contributions, lobby, and endorse candidates. Barry Lynn, executive director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, said he would be watching the nonprofit group to make sure it did not engage in any political activity. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News. Northwest Airlines and negotiators for its 11,000-member flight attendants union have reached a tentative contract agreement. Mark Zedeklik of Minnesota Public Radio reports.
Little information about the tentative agreement is being released other than that the deal proposes a 5-year contract for Northwest Airlines flight attendants. In a joint written statement, the head of the flight attendants union said the Teamsters proudly recommend that the rank and file ratify the agreement. They'll vote through the mail. Northwest Airlines spokesman John Austin says the deal reflects the importance of the flight attendants to the airline.
Clearly, this is good news and, good news for everyone. Whether you're a customer or employee or shareholder, anytime you can take a step forward in this manner, it has to be considered good news.
Just days ago, Northwest's flight attendants overwhelmingly authorized union leaders to call a strike should negotiations fail. For NPR News, this is Mark Sedeklik in St. Paul.
Computer security experts and software companies are warning computer users about a new virus that's spread by email. The virus is called worm.explore.zip. A leading antivirus team at Carnegie Mellon University said it's not clear yet how widely the virus has spread, but the volume of calls about it has been much higher than usual. The virus spreads much like the Melissa virus that overwhelmed email systems last March, replicating itself by sending fresh copies to the addresses in a recipient's address book. The experts say that it's much more damaging than Melissa because it actually destroys files. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are the co-founders of the band Fountains of Wayne, Chris Collingwood and Adam Schlesinger. They have a new CD, their second, called Utopia Parkway. Here's how rock critic Greg Kot described it in Rolling Stone. The duo has a blast celebrating and satirizing the rituals of youth, whether sending up the high school prom themes, joining the caravan to the big rock extravaganza, or trolling the concrete jungle. They create a 14-song tribute to four glorious decades of pop. In Newsweek, critic Karen Schomer said the band has a gift for turning low-key tales of office temps and party girls into hummable little masterpieces. Co-founder Adam Schlesinger received an Academy Award nomination for writing the title song for Tom Hanks' movie That Thing You Do. Let's hear the title song from the new Fountains of Wayne CD, Utopia Parkway.
Well, I've been saving for a custom van.
Collingwood, Adam Schlesinger, welcome to Fresh Air. What's the story behind this song?
The song is about a guy who's playing in a cover band, and he's sort of a little bit too old to be playing in a rock band, but can't quite give up the dream of it. And it was kind of making fun of myself, you know, the absurdity of what we do in a way. But, you know, he's talking about the idea that he's going to take over the town. He's going to make it into New York and conquer the big city.
Before you guys actually succeeded as a band, did you think that you were going to be in this perpetual state of adolescence and never quite making it as a band but being stuck in that place?
You know, it's so hard to say, did you ever think that you'd be stuck in perpetual adolescence? Like, being in a rock band, it's almost something we can't help, you know? You try to be an adult about it, but it is sort of a ridiculous thing to be doing. And I think we actually write about a lot of adolescent and sort of teenage scenarios and things, but for us it's almost more because it's what's traditionally done with the form, and we're really interested in, you know, the form of pop songs. And I'd rather write about a high school prom or something than write about a midlife crisis, you know?
Paying my taxes.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's tax time again. It's that time of year.
Right.
That song is from your new CD, and I'm wondering if you think that you've headed in a new direction on the new CD from the first one.
For us, it's not really a new direction. It's actually more of an old direction, because we played in a series of bands together before we even started Fountains of Wayne. I mean, we've been playing together in one form or another since we were 18. And the stuff that we did originally was more kind of I don't know how to describe it. I mean, less rock and more pop, maybe, you know. And I think that's where this record has gone. So in a weird way, it feels like kind of back to our roots. I mean, when we made our first album, we went into a studio with a Marshall amplifier and just made a lot of noise. And we had never really recorded anything like that before. And so to us, you know, it was like this big rock extravaganza. And although it probably doesn't sound like that to your average teenager, it probably sounds like a wimpy pop band. But on this record, we wanted to have, you know, different kinds of textures on the record, some subtler stuff, some slightly more introspective stuff mixed in with the kind of jokey, fun, loud stuff.
Well, don't sell that first album short. I really like it.
Oh, I don't mean it that way. I mean, the first album was just, it was written in about a week, it was recorded in about another week, and it was just this kind of blast of energy, and I think it's great. I think it's a, you know, it's the perfect way to approach a first record, just have a good time and, you know, create this kind of blueprint for yourself. But we wanted to try to expand on that a little bit and not just do the same thing again.
When your first record came out, rock critic Robert Christgau said that that he thinks you sing the kind of words every shy guy who didn't get the girl thinks of. And I think a good illustration of that point is the song Leave the Biker, which is a really catchy song. Why don't we play that? This is All Leave right. the Biker from the first Fountains of Wayne CD.
Seems the further from town I go, the more I hate this place. He's got leather and big tattoos, scars all over his face. And I wonder if he ever has cried, 'cause he couldn't get a date for the prom. He's got his arm around every man's dream, and crumbs in his beard from the seafood special. Oh, can't you see my world is falling apart? Baby, please leave the biker, leave the biker, break his heart. Baby, please leave the biker, leave the biker, break his heart. Now his friend leans over and says, looks like we got us a fag. I wonder if that guy's read one word that wasn't in a porno mag. And I wonder if he ever has cried, 'cause this kitten got run over and died. He's got his arm around every man's dream, crumbs in his beard from the seafood special. Oh, can't you see my world is falling apart? Baby, please leave the biker, leave the biker, break his heart. Baby, please leave the biker, leave the biker, break his heart.
That's from the first Fountains of Wayne CD. Do you think Robert Christgau was onto something? Do you think of yourselves as former shy guys who didn't get the girl?
I think there's a lot made out of that, actually. And it's funny because...
Too much, you mean?
Well, I think that if people are really eager to call you geek rock or whatever, it sort of lumps you into this convenient category, which ignores the subtler aspects of some of the songwriting, which...
Not that that's the most subtle song that we've ever done.
Right, right. And you know, I mean, to some degree, it might have been a mistake to put that song on the record, because I'd hate to sort of go down in history as this joke songwriter. And
oh, but it's catchy. I don't think I think it's a good song.
No, it is, and I mean, I think the thing is that, you know, obviously that song's supposed to be fun, and a lot of them are, but at the same time, you know, people, especially in America, I think more so even than in Europe, assume that any voice that you have in a song is you confessing, you know, your inner thoughts, and the idea of writing from like the perspective of a character or something is a little bit confusing to people.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times there's songs written that are not literally supposed to be us speaking our minds, and that sometimes gets missed.
Well, there's nice lines in the song, like the line about the guy having crumbs in his beard from the seafood special.
I think the main thing with that whole sort of geeky sort of tag or whatever is that neither of us would be comfortable writing a song that had a really kind of macho, aggressive pose to it. It definitely does come more naturally to us to write from like a weaker perspective, and maybe it's just because it makes the song more sympathetic or something.
Uh-huh. Well, there's that line, I wonder if he's ever cried because he couldn't get a date for the prom. And then there's a prom song on your new CD also that I think is kind of mocking that stereotyped emotion you're supposed to have on the prom, like, this is the crowning moment of my life, and after this I'm going to, like, have a receding hairline and, you know, right. just work all the time and life will be over. It's like the oldest cliche in the book about how you're supposed to feel on prom night.
Yeah, I actually went to two high school proms. I went to my own, and then I went to the prom at the high school where my girlfriend at the time went out on Long Island, and they were both pretty much identical, these kind of suburban proms. And even though I was only, whatever, 17 at the time, I was already too cynical to enjoy it, so I kind of ruined it for both of us. And she never really forgave me, you know. I think that was the beginning of the end of our relationship.
Did you play a lot of proms?
No, but we actually wanted to do that now. We're talking about, you know, trying to get some proms on our tour schedule for this year.
You're kidding, right?
No, I'm not kidding.
Why would you want to do that?
Because we're a really good cover band, although we don't like to admit it, but we always end up playing a lot of covers, and you know, I think it would be fun.
What do you cover?
Anything people yell out. We played a show in Seattle, or Portland, Oregon, I think it was, actually, on our last tour, where we ended up doing one Billy Joel song for every one of our songs. So by the end of the night, I think we had done, you know, 10 or 12 Billy Joel songs, none of which we had ever played before, but...
Actually, the funny thing about that is, like, I found that online about 6 months later. It had become this sort of legendary thing, like, in some news group that was, like,
they had the set list.
Huge, big discussion.
Then they did Just a Fantasy, and then they did, you know, Allentown. It was great.
My guests are the co-founders of the band Fountains of Wayne, Chris Collingwood and Adam Schlesinger. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are the co-founders of the band Fountains of Wayne, Chris Collingwood and Adam Schlesinger. Their new CD is called Utopia Parkway. How did you first meet? You've been playing together a long time.
Yeah, we met in college. We were both, I think, about 19 at the time. We've sort of been playing steadily in bands ever since then. We had about 10 different bands throughout since about 1987
yeah,
to the present, most of which were incredibly terrible, and they all had really horrible names. And we actually
such as
we used to change our name, you know, once a week
because people who saw us once, like if we advertised with the same name, they'd never come back. We were called Woolly Mammoth.
That was about
three people who, when standing side by side, have a wingspan of over 12 feet.
Are you my mother?
Are you my mother?
why did you call the band that?
That's a children's book, actually.
Green Light Go is another children's book.
The silly thing is that Fountains of Wayne was just one of these, in the pile of names that we would just kind of rotate, and that ended up being the one that we got stuck with. But I kind of prefer Are You My Mother, actually. Maybe we should switch it.
Well, how did you come up with Fountains of Wayne, and why is that the name that stuck?
Fountains of Wayne is a store in the town called Wayne, New Jersey, which is near where I grew up. And I think it was something that my mother actually suggested at some point. I mean, she works in Clifton.
That was about 10 years ago.
Yeah, while we were probably...
While we were tossing around all these bad band names.
And she was always full of, you know, really horrible ideas for, things we should do to help the band out. So she would suggest these terrible names, and we'd say, oh, God, that's a horrible band name. And she would also say things like... Why don't you guys play shows where you have two pianos on stage and you can both play piano and that'll be your gimmick? and I just say, I really don't have time to explain why that's a bad idea right now, but at some point I will.
My family was always saying, why don't you go on that David Letterman show? That seems to do those bands a lot of good.
Was she offering to get you on?
Yeah. No, she's just, that was her idea for promotion.
I want to play another recording from your first CD, and this is called She's Got a Problem. I think this is also a really good song. Would you say anything about writing it? Which of you wrote this one?
I wrote it, although Chris had the title. And I kind of took the title and wrote a song around it. I mean, one thing that we did early on a lot was to just sit down and kind of throw out possible song titles, and then it was almost a game to see if, you know, who could turn it into an actual song.
Yeah, we actually sat in a bar and wrote them on bar napkins. I don't know if you still have those, but I have a napkin
you know, with like 50 possible titles, and most of the songs on our first album are on there somewhere, and then there's a bunch of really bad ones that we couldn't even bring ourselves to write. So, yeah, I mean, She's Got a Problem, funnily enough, was a song that I had sort of been working on a little bit, and when Chris suggested that title, I kind of grafted onto this idea that I had, you know, rolling around.
There's a good image. You grafted it.
I grafted it.
Because it was a burn victim.
Grafted it like a burn victim onto my idea.
So why don't we hear She's Got a Problem from the first Fountains of Wayne CD. Chris Collingwood and Adam Schlesinger, Fountains of Wayne, and that's from their first CD. They have a new CD, which is called Utopia Parkway.
We should mention, too, by the way, that the band at this point is not just the two of us, although it pretty much was making that first record, but we're actually a four-piece band now, and we have a drummer named Brian Young, who was in the Posies for a long time, and a guitar player named Jody Porter, and they joined the band right after we finished making that first record, and they toured with us for that whole last year. And on this new record, we actually recorded it in a more traditional kind of band style with all of us playing.
When you wanted to expand the band, did you find the people you wanted to play with in an organic way, or did you actually hold auditions and so on?
We actually tried to hold auditions, didn't we?
Oh, my God, it was the most ludicrous thing you've ever seen.
You know, we put an ad in the Village Voice or something and just... You know, I think we met every horrible musician in the New York area. And it's just, I can't even begin to tell you how funny those auditions are.
I think there are people who just make a career out of going to rock auditions. And you can probably tell, like, the guys who showed up, you know, it's their fifth one that day. I can't understand why things aren't going right for them.
Well, how did you tell them what you wanted to hear, or would they just come up with like an audition piece and perform it for you?
Well, most of the time they had a copy of a demo or something, and we're kind of like learn this song and just, you know, wing it, whatever. So they'd show up and plug in, and they'd leave, and we'd laugh, and
then the next guy would come in. I mean, as it turned out, you know, that proved futile really quickly, and so Jody, the guitar player, was someone that I knew because he was the leader of a band for a long time called the Bell Tower, and I had actually played bass for his band briefly. And then Brian, we actually met through a friend of ours who knew Brian from his work with the Posies, and we had never met him, but he just came down. We actually auditioned him in Los Angeles, but the audition was really just kind of a free-for-all.
Getting together, playing Blue Oyster Cult songs.
Yeah, and Steve Miller covers and things. I mean, we knew kind of instantly that he was the right guy, and if it's just whether he wanted to do it or not, we just had a good time playing.
Brian's kind of the rock star in the group, actually. Like, everywhere we go in Europe, everybody's like, they know the Posies really well. So
he's the touring veteran. He was kind of showing us the ropes as we went.
Some people who don't even know that it's Brian in the band will show up and recognize his drum kit, and they say, "Wow, you know, did you guys buy the Posies drum kit?" We're like, no.
So what's the best advice he gave you on weathering a tour?
Well, you know, his whole philosophy is whenever you start complaining too much, you got to just remember that it beats flipping eggs. That's his expression. You know, you can be sitting in some, you know, train station in Germany for 8 hours, and he can say, well, it beats flipping eggs.
That's probably not bad advice.
No.
So, sometimes it doesn't beat flipping eggs.
That's right.
It's the actually, one thing he forgot.
Flipping eggs might be kind of fun right about now.
Your knowledge of rock and pop goes back a long way, and I'm wondering, what do you remember the first records you each bought?
I think the first full-length LP I was ever allowed to buy was Bat Outta Hell by Meatloaf. My parents obviously had all those Beatles records sitting around and stuff, but I remember, I think I was in sixth grade when Bat Outta Hell came out. It was that record.
You were like,
and,
whoa.
Yeah, and a really cool, that motorcycle on the cover was just so excellent.
The first record I ever bought was this exercise record that they made us buy in first grade. It was called Chicken Fat.
We had to listen to that
record
too. Yeah.
It was like push-ups every morning.
10 times.
Not just now and then, 10 times.
One, two.
And they'd make you exercise to it, and then they'd also make you buy it.
It would give that chicken right back, give that chicken fight back to the chicken, and don't be chicken again.
I can't believe you. You're the only person I've ever mentioned this to that knows what the hell I'm talking about.
I want to know what kind of fascist elementary school you went to. Chicken fight.
Chicken fat.
Chicken fat.
Oh, was this really funny?
Kill all the weak students. The strong students will survive.
Kill the weak.
Oh, it was this military-style workout record, yeah. Oh,
that's man. Just horrible.
So you really liked it? This is an influence on your music?
I never said I liked it.
And tell me again why you brought it up.
You asked us the first record we ever bought.
Oh, and they made you buy it.
Oh, yeah, it was forced purchase.
That's right.
I should suggest to our record company that strategy of forcing first graders to buy our album. Because there's a lot of first graders out there, you know, and they've all got lunch money.
That's a good idea.
We could just go rob them instead of making them buy the records.
Yeah, why bring this whole record thing into it?
Adam Schlesinger and Chris Collingwood are the co-founders of the band Fountains of Wayne. Their new CD is called Utopia Parkway. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I brought a 38 special CD collection, some back.
Stations by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Time Magazine. This week, Princess Diana, Che Guevara, Harvey Milk, and Jackie Robinson are profiled among 20 of Time's heroes and icons of the 20th century. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with Fountains of Wayne. And Tom Perata talks about his novels, The Wishbones, about a rock band stuck playing weddings, and Election, the basis of the current film starring Matthew Broderick and Reese Witherspoon.
I got a flair for pulling your hair, making you crazy. Oh yeah, oh yeah, it's something I do well. I got a flair for making you care. You know you should hate me. Oh yeah, oh yeah, it's something I do well. I got a flair for
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the co-founders of the band Fountains of Wayne, Chris Collingwood and Adam Schlesinger. They have a new CD called Utopia Parkway. Adam, I have a question for you. You wrote that song, That Thing You Do, for the Tom Hanks movie. And
I did.
I thought that was a surprisingly good movie that had a really kind of knowing and loving sense of 60s pop. How did you come to write the song? Was there like a national audition being held for the song, or?
Not really. I mean, it was just somebody in the music business that I work with at a music publishing company heard about the movie and said that, you know, they were looking for a song that kind of sounded like this era, and asked me if I wanted to take a stab at it. So I did a demo recording of it with two friends, and we just sent it in. And, you know, we did it really quickly because we just kind of assumed it was such a long shot. It wasn't worth spending that much time on. But, you know, they actually listened to it and they actually liked it. So it was a lucky break.
Yeah, and the movie is about a band that's a one-hit wonder. And the only hit that they have is this song, That Thing You Do. And it's a really catchy record. What did you think about when you wrote this song, knowing that it needed to be a period song?
Well, the obvious reference for the time period they were talking about was the Beatles, but they actually had, as part of the instructions for it, had said that, you know, we'd rather have it sound like an American band that's, you know, kind of a cheap imitation of the Beatles, you know, because there were a lot of bands sprouting up then.
The Knickerbockers.
Yeah, that kind of stuff, you know, trying to capitalize on what the Beatles had done. So that's what I was going for.
Okay. Well, this is your song, That Thing You Do. Songs from the Tom Hanks movie, The Thing You Do, and the song was written by my guest Adam Schlesinger, who along with my other guest Chris Collingwood co-founded Fountains of Wayne, and they have a new CD called Utopia Parkway. Chris, I know you had to cancel a concert recently because you had a sore throat. Has that happened to you a lot, and is it really upsetting when there's something totally out of control, out of your control, that forces you to cancel a concert?
It is really upsetting, but in this case, you know, you just sort of realize there's nothing I can do about it. It's only happened once before, and that was on the West Coast 2 years ago. And at that time, it was because of fatigue. We had done like 5 shows in a row, and I just got hoarse. This time around, I've just got an infection, and there really was nothing I could do about it. I went to a doctor, and he just told me that if I took steroids, it would probably make it worse.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we did a show the night before. We canceled that show, and I ended up singing about 3/4 of the set, which I never, ever do. And then after that, we turned it into sort of a karaoke night, and we asked people from the audience to sing different songs. And actually, it was really fun. Everyone had a good time, but the final song of the night, we did a song called Please Don't Rock Me Tonight, and anyone named Dan was invited to come up on stage and sing. So we had about 8 guys and 2 girls who claimed their name was Dan.
That's funny. I have to ask you about that song. Do you see that song as a song about somebody who doesn't want to hear a certain kind of heavy rock or somebody who doesn't want to make love?
See, it's funny that you say that because when I wrote that song, I had nothing of that in mind. I
mean, either?
It was just totally... Well, no, I had... It was just about hearing loud rock.
Uh-huh.
And...
And after
funny
the
you
fact...
say make love because the English press chose a different word for it. But... yeah, everybody in England, pretty much the entire press there, just assumed it was about sex, and it really had nothing to do with that, but, you know, whatever.
Neither of us has actually ever had sex, so it was more...
I don't have any basis
too busy
to
with this band.
Well, Adam, I should mention, you recently got married, and that leads me to ask you whether you know, it's another step in the rock songwriting career. Now you're going to have to turn from lyrics about proms to lyrics about married life.
Yeah, actually, my wife is constantly berating me for not having written any songs with her name in it. And so, you know, I'm always trying to convince her that every song is actually about her, and it's just very subtle. You know?
I actually am.
It's like, what do you mean, Laser Show? That's about you. It's a love song.
I wrote a song about Adam's wife just to make her happy.
Yeah.
It's called Katie Boat. You remember that?
Yeah, her name is Katie. And sing the song. It's pretty good.
Let's take a ride in our Katie Boat. It's not really, I don't know what it's about, really.
It's probably not what she had in mind.
No, she suggested that we should put out a song called Katie, Katie Love Song, but I haven't worked on that one yet.
Well, let's close with a song from the new CD. I was thinking of playing Troubled Times. What do you think?
Sounds like a wonderful idea.
And who wrote that one?
That's one of mine.
Good. Say something about writing it.
That's actually an older song that it's been around since before our first record. It's kind of like what our band sounded like before we bought amplifiers, and also before we decided to kind of incorporate that wacky sense of humor. and oddly enough, it was sort of written about Adam and his ex-girlfriend trying to get them back together.
Didn't work, though.
It didn't work.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you both very much. And Chris, I hope your throat feels better real soon.
Well, thank you.
Adam Schlesinger and Chris Collingwood are the co-founders of the band Fountains of Wayne. Their new CD is called Utopia Parkway.
When you think you found something worth holding on to, were you reaching for attention, hoping she would notice you collecting bottles and throwing away cans like she was returnable, one day would refill your hands? How she loved you, all you imagine fits so well into your plan.
Coming up, Tom Perata, the author of the novel Election, which is the basis of the current film starring Matthew Broderick and Reese Witherspoon. This is Fresh Air. Tom Perata's novel Election is the basis of the current film comedy of the same name. That novel has just been published in paperback, along with new editions of his first two books, Bad Haircut, Stories of the 70s, and The Wishbones, about a musician who wants to be a rock star but is stuck playing weddings. Election is about a high school teacher, Mr. M., played in the film by Matthew Broderick, whose responsibilities include overseeing the high school election. When the story begins, only one student is running, Tracy Flick, played in the movie by Reese Witherspoon. She gets on Mr. M.'s nerves. She's too smart, too neat, too perky. Plus, she had an affair with another teacher, Mr. M.'s best friend, who as a result was fired from the school. So Mr. M. wants to make sure that she has some competition in the election. He convinces one of the school's popular football heroes, who has been sidelined by a broken leg, to run for office. Here's the scene in which Tracy's found out he's running.
Who put you up to this?
Oh, hi, Tracy.
Who put you up to this?
What do you mean?
You just woke up this morning and suddenly decided to run for president?
No. I just thought that,
Thought what?
Well, I was talking to Mr. McAllister about my leg and how I still want to do something for the school, and...
So Mr. McAllister asked you to run?
Well, I talked to him and everything, but he just said that he thought it would be a good idea and how there's all different kinds of fruits and, well, it's nothing against you, Tracy. I mean, you're the best. I just thought,
Okay, you're on, Mr. Popular.
A scene from Election, adapted from Tom Perata's novel of the same name. Here's Tom Perata reading a paragraph from Tracy's point of view.
All right, so I slept with my English teacher and ruined his marriage. Crucify me. Send me to bad girl prison with Amy Fisher and make TV movies about my pathetic life. If I'd been on better terms with Mr. M, I could have explained to him that my punishment for sleeping with Jack was having to sleep with Jack. It pretty much cured me the older man fantasy, let me tell you that. Until Paul entered the race, I was running unopposed. People understood that I deserved to win. They didn't necessarily like me, but they respected my qualifications. President of the junior class, treasurer of the SGA, assistant editor of the Watchdog, statistician for the basketball team, and star of last year's musical, Oklahoma, in case you're wondering. And I did all of it while conducting a fairly torrid affair with a married man, even if he did turn out to be as big a baby as any 16-year-old.
Tom Perata reading from his novel Election. One of the epigraphs opening the book reads, "The world is the school gone mad."
It was William Trevor's from a novel called The Old Boys, which is about these retired, you know, elderly men returning to their prep school and sort of remembering from a distance of, you know, maybe 50 years that world and how much it had marked their lives later on. So it seemed very...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, it just seemed very appropriate for Election.
Well, it seems very appropriate for how we see the world, too, because so often the world does look like a bad version of high school, as if high school wasn't strange enough.
Mm-hmm.
But even in politics, too, you can so often look at a congressman or even a president and feel like you know them from high school. You know what type they were in high school.
Well, that was, in fact, one of the real starting points I had for Election. I was... kind of obsessed with the 1992 election, particularly the three candidates, and I watched it in a way I hadn't watched other elections, and I got deeply involved in the political process. But one nagging thought kept coming to me, which was, you know, I knew those people in high school. I didn't like them in high school, and I like them even less now that they're going to be running my life. And also, I had this feeling that the level of oratory. It didn't improve very much from high school to, grand stages of political conventions.
Now, why did you want to set a novel in high school in addition to this idea that the world is the school gone mad? Had you ever taught in high school? I know you've taught college.
Yeah, no, I haven't. But I think partly because I did teach college, and I've taught at Yale and at Harvard, and I've lived my professional life in a kind of rarefied climate, but I went to... a public school in working class part of New Jersey, and did have some idea in the back of my head that high school was the last time I really was part of America in terms of, you know, having to mingle with, people who didn't belong to some self-proclaimed elite. So in my own mind, I think, you know, high school exists as a kind of democratic interlude in my own life. So I think it's like partly a feeling, as you say, that this world is the school gone mad, but also this you know, personal mythology that says high school is America, you know, and college is some, you know, rarefied place where you kind of escape from America.
Well, let me read something that the teacher, Mr. M, is thinking about one of his students who is not mingling very well in school. And he says, "Lisa Flanagan was exactly the kind of kid I was trying to reach, a smart, unhappy girl who wanted nothing more than to be accepted by the jock cheerleader aristocracy at the school and had no idea, how could she, of how relieved she was going to be to find a different world in college, more charitable standards of value." Well, you've taught at college. You've taught at Harvard. Do you think the standards are more charitable?
Yeah, I do. And particularly, I think, for smart kids. I mean, I think in various ways, you know, college has its own systems of oppression, but I remember feeling, you know, deeply liberated the day I got to college, and that's a feeling that sticks with me. And in fact, I was teaching a class not long ago and on election, and some students were asking me, you know, what do I believe? And they had some sense that the book was cynical or nihilistic. You know, you don't believe in democracy, or you don't believe in that teachers are, you know, good examples. What do you believe in? And I thought for a few seconds, and I thought, oh, college, I think.
You were teaching when you wrote the novel Election, and I'm wondering if you saw yourself as a teacher differently after writing Election and examining the motives of the teacher in the book.
It's an interesting thing, because I think, you know, around the same time as I wrote it, you know, I had just gotten married, and I think that changed my sense of myself as a teacher. I think it's hard to know if the book did it or if the change in the period of my life did it, but I do know that I went from being one of those teachers who felt himself sort of in the thick of the class and just another one of the students who in some way had, you know, was getting paid to lead the class, to really feeling some distance from my students and feeling myself in a slightly more official position. And part of that was just cultural as well. You know, one of the things Election is about is sexual harassment. And around the time I wrote it, it had become, you know, a deeply important issue in you know, on American campuses. And suddenly things that people had done all the time. I mean, I remember being in school in the 1980s and, you know, knowing people who had affairs with teachers. And, you know, there was some sense that that was risky or interesting or daring or problematic, but no sense that it was, say, illegal, you know. And you'd suddenly meet teachers who are saying, well, you know, I have to keep my door open at all times. I want people around. You know, it was both personal, cultural, and related to the book Election. It's hard for me to separate all those things, but I did feel that, you know, I could no longer be just, you know, one of the kids in the class.
How did your Harvard students react when they found out that your novel had been optioned by MTV Films?
Well, you know, they were totally excited, and this is one of those things, I think, that another change I can mark between the early 80s and now, and that's that when I was in college, people who wanted to be writers wanted to be fiction writers and poets, and now people who want to be writers, particularly at Harvard, you know, which is a great feeder for Hollywood. You know, they want to write movies and TV shows. So there's some way in which, you know, I became much more interesting to them when I had this movie. But I remember that I was trying to describe to them what the story was about. And I said, yeah, and it's about this election for high school president. You know, what could be more meaningless than to be elected president of your high school? You know, what an empty charade that is. And I remember, you know, pausing and seeing all these stricken looks among the former high school presidents who were in my class.
That's funny.
One guy, yeah, one of whom had written this book about, you know, how to actually improve the world through student government.
I take it you never ran yourself.
Well, my high school career, you know, I had a certain kind of career. I was a homeroom representative for 4 years, and I remember that every year we debated whether or not we were going to get a smoking lounge.
My guest is Tom Perata. His novel Election is the basis of the current film of the same name. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Perata. His novel Election has been republished to coincide with the release of its film adaptation. There's also a new edition of his novel The Wishbones, about a rock band that plays weddings. He's currently writing a movie adaptation of it. In the acknowledgments for your novel The Wishbones, the novel about a band that plays weddings. You thank Mike Parada and all the members of RSVP, one of New Jersey's finest wedding bands, for letting you watch them in action. Is Mike your brother?
Mike is my cousin, but he's been a very influential figure for me. And he's also a high school teacher, by the way. So obviously, I'm like following the world that he's in very closely.
So he plays in a wedding band?
Yeah, he plays in the wedding band, RSVP. There are a lot of guys who I grew up with and who I think are wonderful musicians. And, you know, there was a point when I'd heard that they were in a wedding band where I thought that, you know, I don't know how much they would like that because they wanted to be rock stars, and it seemed like a comedown. But when I would go back to town and talk to them about it, I got the sense that, you know, they were really happy just to be making music and to be making money at it. And it led me to a kind of rethinking of what it might mean and how hard it is for people who want to do an art or have a passion in their life to keep doing it, and how that's kind of a triumph in itself.
One of the bands that you describe in The Wishbones is a band of older musicians, musicians who were veterans of the big band era, and they always open their set with Kool and the Gang's Celebrate, because there's a celebration that they're playing for.
Yes.
I thought that was very funny that they'd open that way. I'm sure I've seen this band. Was there a real band you based it on?
Yeah, I went to a friend's wedding in New Haven, and there's these old guys in powder blue uniforms. And, you know, I think I grew up with rock and roll. I grew up in a youth culture. And, you know, we now see all these you know, I saw Bob Dylan last year. You know, he's getting up there. You know, at one point rock and roll was a young person's game. And now, in some funny way, it's becoming an older person's game. And I was so thrilled by these guys to see how much energy they had and how much fun they were having. And they were working, you know, they were probably in their 60s and 70s, and they were working hard. And it did give me a glimpse of, you know, a nice life. I mean, how many people who pursue an art get to pursue it all the way through to the end of their lives? And how many people get to do it in this particular culture where, you know, youth is so highly valued and people in lots of fields find that their careers are over when they're, you know, in their 30s and 40s.
Have you ever had a Cater to Fear yourself in which you had a band like that playing?
You know what? I had to go the DJ route, which is a, you know, for a cousin of a guy in a wedding band, is sort of a letdown. You know, one of the things I have fun with in the Wishbones is the clash between wedding musicians and DJs. You know, the musicians really look down on DJs, and there's a kind of a deep-seated grudge. You know, it's expensive to hire a band, but they're actually making the music, whereas the DJ's just, you know, taking CDs out of the cases.
Actually, let me quote what one of the band members thinks. He hates the DJs because, quote, they were a revolting breed, scam artists who'd somehow managed to convince the world that it took talent to remove CDs from a plastic case while simultaneously jabbering into a microphone.
And the funny thing in the Wishbones, I think, is that the DJ who plays the wedding turns out to be a kind of psychic brother to the main character, Dave, who's a guitar player. It turns out that this guy, Rockin' Randy, is not so different from a Wishbone. He's a guy who just has this deep passion for music and is trying to find a way to fit it into his life. You know, and he has a day job at an insurance company, but he stays up late to do this, you know, 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. jazz radio show at a public station in Bridgeport, Connecticut. So that, you know, I was really interested in these characters who, as they get older, will do what they have to do to keep their passion for whatever it is, whether it's making music or playing music or writing poetry. Or there's even a nut who has a right-wing talk show on cable access.
What's been the equivalent for you until now as a writer? I mean, what has your ambition been to keep on writing, whether you're published or not, you know, whether you're acclaimed or not, whether you make any money at it or not?
Yeah, well, it was actually at the time I was writing The Wishbones was a real issue in my life. I was unable to find a teaching job for a year and, you know, had gotten married and was thinking of starting a family and was really worried that the kind of life I'd led through my 20s where I was able to get by on, you know, very small amount of money was about to come to an end. I mean, and for all that time, I had some sense that my salvation would be a teaching job, as it is for lots of writers in America. But I was also trying to figure out ways to make money as a writer, and I was ghostwriting, at that point, teen horror novels.
No kidding.
But also, yeah, yeah. I swore a pledge of secrecy, so I can't tell you whose novels I was ghostwriting, but they're very popular teen horror novels.
Now, why would you have to take a pledge of secrecy? Because you were protecting the identity of the... You were protecting the fact that you were writing it from... Right.
Under somebody else's name, because this other person makes a big deal about, you know, being prolific and writing them all himself. And in the course of that, I was reading a lot of teen series novels like Sweet Valley High and 18 Pine Street, some of which, you know, lurk in the back of Election. I was really writing Election in some ways to, you know, fill in the blanks in these young adult books.
So was writing teenage horror stories under the name of this other author, was that the equivalent for you of playing in a wedding band?
In a way it was, because even though I could barely read these books that I was ghostwriting, I did have this odd sense of pride that, well, at the very least, you know, I've spent my life learning how to write, and now I can make a living at it. And it was better to sit home and work for 3 hours on my computer than to go and, you know, be a temp proofreader for $10 or $12 an hour. So there was some way in which I began to understand just that sort of small pleasure of being a professional, of having some skill that I could use to make a living. I'd also done some advertising copywriting and had a similar feeling. And I also think you learn a kind of writerly discipline that some people learn through journalism. But yeah, I think to practice your art in such a way that you can make a living off of it gives you a certain kind of pride and teaches you some lessons about not treating it as a sacred task, but as work. You know, and there may be something sacred about work, but it's a little different from, you know, I can't work today because the muses aren't here.
Well, Tom Perotta, it's really been a pleasure to talk with you. I want to wish you good luck with the adaptation that you're writing of your novel, The Wishbones. And congratulations on Election being made into a movie. And thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Tom Perotta's books, Bad Haircut, The Wishbones, and Election, have been republished to coincide with the film adaptation of Election. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Joan Tuohy Westman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
There's a party going on right here, a celebration to last throughout the years. So bring your good times and your laughter too. We gon' celebrate your party with you. Come on now. Let's all celebrate and have a good time. Celebration. We gon' celebrate and have a good time. It's time to come together.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, designing cars with a philosophy that performance and safety should go hand in hand. Information available at www.saabusa.com. And from Little Brown & Company, publisher of The Majors, In Pursuit of Golf's Holy Grail by NPR contributor John Feinstein. Available in hardcover and as a Time Warner audiobook. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, the man behind Austin Powers, Mike Myers. He spoofs spy films of the 60s again in his new film, The Spy Who Shagged Me. Then we'll hear from John Barry, who composed the music for most of the James Bond films. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.